So Ajahn Sudhakar has laid all the groundwork for us this morning, basically talked about meditation in a very broad way, all the various, the kind of expansive view of meditation. So what I want to do now is that because this idea of this course is to have talk about early Buddhism, the idea now is basically to compare what did the Buddha say about meditation and how does that compare to several of the modern ideas about what meditation is all about. So I want to compare what the sutras say and compare that to kind of common ideas in the present day about meditation practice. And this is the idea behind this is simply to look, to be more clear about how the Buddha taught these things. And we have called this early Buddhism versus 20th century Buddhism, 20th century meditation. And the idea here, I suppose, is that a lot of these ideas are already in the past, right? Meditation is always changing. The idea of Buddhism is always changing. Things are always changing. Things are always moving forward. And ideas, even about meditation, even about Buddhism, they have a certain context, often like a historical context. They exist for a certain reason, because of a certain culture, because of certain influences, because of certain ways of reading the suttas, etc. And as time goes by, these things always change. So there are periods when certain types of meditation is prevalent. There are other periods when other types of meditation is prevalent. Things are always changing, always moving on. So for this reason, it's always very useful to try to go back to what the Buddha taught and see whether the present way of doing things actually matches how the Buddha taught these things. So my first point here, this is the summary of what I'm going to talk about for the next couple of hours. And the first point here is samatha and vipassana versus samatha contra vipassana. And the idea here is that very often when we hear about meditation practice, you often hear about this, what people will call the two branches of meditation, one being the samatha meditation, another being vipassana meditation. And of course, once you divide meditation up into two branches, then you get a conflict, right? Which one should we choose? Should we do samatha? Should we do vipassana? There's like two. There's a choice there suddenly once you have this idea of a division between the two. But the interesting thing, even though that is quite a common idea in modern Buddhism, you would say that anapanasati, watching the breath, is a samatha meditation, whereas like watching the feelings in the body might be called vipassana meditation. You don't actually find this difference in the suttas. The suttas don't talk about this distinction. In the suttas, there's just meditation. It is not divided up between one type and another type. So how does this then work out? This is one of the things I want to talk about. How can this be that there is no distinction between the two? How can meditation, in a sense, be both at the same time? How does this actually work out? The second point here is about is what I've called here satipatthana leads to jhana versus satipatthana equals vipassana. This is another very important aspect in meditation as far as the suttas are concerned. And when you look at the contemporary ideas about satipatthana practice, they always say there's very strong emphasis of non-satipatthana being equivalent to vipassana. And if it is equivalent to vipassana, the extension of that is that satipatthana practice leads to wisdom. Whereas other practices, which might be anapanasati, for example, that leads to samadhi, right, or samatha. This idea, again, that these things actually are different. But if you look at the suttas, how the Buddha talked about satipatthana, and to be able to see that, you have to look at the suttas in a slightly different way from the way it is normally looked at. It is very, very prevalent. It's actually all over the place that satipatthana is directly causally related to jhana. One comes first, and the other one is the result of doing satipatthana. So jhana actually comes from satipatthana practice. So how does that work? Does that mean that satipatthana is all about samatha? Does it mean it's all, how does it actually function? How is this possible that this actually is the case? One way of actually arriving at that conclusion, one of the very obvious ways, is that the standard way of looking at satipatthana is basically just to look at the Satipatthana Sutta. And if you look at the Satipatthana Sutta in isolation, it actually can be very difficult to be clear about what's going on, because the sutta itself has been pointed out by several scholars, is a very complicated sutta. It seems to have gone through a period of evolution up to the present day, and it's quite hard to pinpoint exactly what is going on in that sutta. The only way you can really understand Satipatthana in context, understand what it's supposed to do, where it comes from, is to actually look at how Satipatthana is used contextually in the suttas. So you have to look at the suttas, but Satipatthana is like only one factor, and look at the factors around it, and see how it relates to the other factors. And if you do that, it's very obvious how Satipatthana is supposed to be used. Okay, so that is the second thing I want to look at. I'm going to look a bit more detail in a minute about this. Then we have the third factor here, bliss is essential versus bliss is dangerous. Okay, I think that's fairly self-explanatory. I'm going to, of course, one of the things in often modern meditation practice, this idea that you get attached to bliss and it's going to stop you from having success in meditation practice, is quite a common one. Is there any basis for that in the suttas? Do the suttas speak like that? How do the suttas relate to the idea of bliss or happiness or joy or etc. in meditation practice? Then we have the two last ones here. One that I have called the skillful elimination versus the suppression of the hindrances. And the last one is stillness versus concentration. So the last one there, stillness versus concentration, is really just about how translation can affect how we understand meditation practice. These are just different translations, really, of the same term. And skillful elimination versus suppression of the hindrances. This is about how we use the mind to get rid of hindrances in meditation. Both of the last two ones here concern willpower, the use of willpower contra the use of skillful means to advance your meditation. So they are very closely related to each other here. Okay, so there we are. This is basically what I will be covering over the next hour and a half or 2 hours or whatever here. Okay, so let us start with the first one. So samatha and vipassana. So to even be able to understand how these terms relate to each other and what they, how they relate to Satipatthana, how they relate to meditation practice proper, it is important to understand what they actually are. What do these things actually mean? And samatha is usually translated as calm in almost all translations from the Pali to the English, and I think calm is a reasonable translation. It means anything right from calm, tranquility, peace, all of these things is the idea of samatha. The samatha is like one aspect of the mind, a certain emotion, if you like, in the mind is samatha. That's what it's about. It is looking at the mind from a certain perspective, a certain angle, and this is the calm angle, the tranquility angle. But samatha is not a state. It's very different from the word samadhi. The word samadhi, which is often translated as concentration, actually is a state, right? Samadhi is the four jhanas, four very clear states. And because samadhi is a state, it is actually something is relatively easy to pin down because it actually refers to something very specific. And in the sutta, samadhi is always defined very clearly. You get a number of, like the first jhana is defined with a very specific formula. And the good thing about that is very easy to pin down. And you can use that as a guideline, as a signpost, if you like, in your meditation practice. You see the sign, you have the factors of the first jhana, so you know where you're at. But samatha is not like that. Samatha does not refer to a particular state. Samatha just means calm. And the word calm is a relative word, right? Calm compared to what? Well, calm compared to where you were before. So if you are practicing the path, you're supposed to get more samatha. And as you move along, the samatha increases. So even practicing things like sila, like virtue, practicing kindness, practicing metta, practicing all these things, all of these things are actually, an aspect of these things is samatha, because all of these things lead to greater calm. Then you start doing meditation, watching the breath, you start contemplating the Dhamma in the right way, you start getting maybe insights and understandings, etc. The calm deepens again, right? The calm becomes deeper and deeper and deeper. It's a very elastic term. It goes from the very beginning of the path to the very end. The highest kind of calm, of course, is the kind of calm you have when you attain full awakening eventually. So that is samatha. It's a very broad term. So what about vipassana? Again, I think it's important to get to grips with what this term actually means. It is very often translated as insight. This word vipassana, is that a good translation? I think it is fairly good. I don't think it's wrong. But I prefer the translation clear seeing for vipassana. The word vipassana itself is very much related to seeing. The idea of passana is actually itself means seeing, and vi is a prefix that can be interpreted in many ways, but it's basically about seeing this thing. It can be maybe analytical seeing or something like that. But clear seeing seems to be one of the clear usages of this word in the suttas. Another translation would simply be clarity. We have clarity about things. So what sort of clarity do we have? And I think we all know what clarity means. When you have a clear mind, it means you're not confused, you're not deluded, you're not very scattered with many things, you don't have great desires or great anger. Clarity is a sense of you know what's going on. You have a sense of perspective. You can see what's happening here. So this is the vipassana, is that kind of clarity. And of course that clarity here, it then moves into the sort of profound insight that we talk about in Buddhism. That is the insight into impermanence, right? Suffering and non-self. That is also included there. Clarity is, in the end, it's a clarity about these particular issues that vipassana is about. But just like samatha, just like calm, vipassana is something that develops from the very beginning to the very end. When you start to keep the precepts, when you start to act with kindness and morality, etc., you find that your clarity starts to increase, right? So clarity increases all the way through her. And in this way, vipassana can be actually said to be something that goes with you on the path from the very beginning to the very end. Vipassana is this thing here. And you find this in the suttas. You find that the way samatha and vipassana are used in the suttas, they're usually used as a combination. It's called samatha vipassana, one compound, one word basically, together. So these are qualities that go together. They move together as you're developing the path. So I think this is quite important, because what this means is that samatha and vipassana essentially are results of the practice. These are not things you do as such, but they are results of the practice. They're both results of meditation practice, and they always go together. When there's calm, there is clarity. When there's clarity, there's also calm. So how do these things interrelate with each other? One of the things that you find in the suttas as well, as I was mentioning now, where there's calm, there's clarity. So these things are two aspects of the same thing here, essentially here. You will hear that from, I think you will see that as part of your own experience, how clarity and calm go together. That is certainly what it says in the suttas. And you also hear people like, the famous saying by Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah said that vipassana and samatha are like two sides of the same knife. You cannot have a one-sided knife, right? A knife always comes, by definition, with two sides. In the same way, calm and clarity are two aspects of the same mind which is developed through meditation practice. So when we practice meditation, how does this actually work? How is it that samatha is vipassana? How is it that vipassana actually is samatha? And I think it's quite interesting to think about that a little bit, because once you kind of get a conceptual idea of how these things work, they start to make more sense. I find it very useful myself to have conceptual clarity about such things. But let's take samatha first. If you're practicing samatha, let's say you're watching the breath, and you're becoming calmer as you watch the breath. So what is happening? You're becoming calmer. Basically, that means that the defilements are decreasing, right? Desire is a defilement that leads to movement. You're looking into the future, looking for the object of your desire. Anger is often looking into the past. Again, it's a movement of the mind away from the present moment. The same is true of restlessness and these things. So calming the mind down means basically you're calming the defilements, right? So by watching the breath, you're calming the defilements. When you are calming the defilements, what happens? You see more clearly. Why? Because the defilements are precisely those things that distort the mind. The defilements are the things which make you see happiness where there is no happiness. The defilements are the things that make you think that you need things which you don't. The defilements are the things which make you think that being angry and upset is okay here in a particular situation, right? This is the nature of defilements. They distort the clarity of vision here. So defilements do two things. They lead away from calm, and they also distort your vision of things. And because they lead away from calm, and because they distort the vision of things, they are also contrary to both samatha and vipassana. So, reducing the defilements, you're actually improving both the samatha and vipassana at the same time. Because the defilements have these two qualities to them, not peaceful and distorting reality, distorting the world as it is. You can also look at it from the other side, if you like. You can actually ask yourself, you do some kind of contemplation, which might be called an insight contemplation, or you might just call it a development of the mind, or development of sannya. This is one of the things you see in the sutta as well, the development of perception, sannya. So let's take one very simple perception that the Buddha recommends a lot in the suttas. Now that perception is the perception of death. You see that all over the place in the suttas, highly recommended by the Buddha. So if you develop the perception of death, what are you actually doing here? What you're doing is that you're reminding yourself of the impermanence of things, right? You're going to lose everything around you, relationships, the things you own, the people who are most dear to you, they're all going to fade, they're all going to disappear, basically, when you die here. Your own body is going to die here. So basically, there's a massive change in your life. It reminds you of impermanence. But also, it reminds you of suffering, right? If things are impermanent and you are attached to these things that are impermanent, you're going to suffer when they get taken away. So it reminds you of suffering as well. And of course, it also reminds you of non-self because you cannot control these things. These things are going to happen according to their own nature, whether you want to or not. So what happens there? What happens if you are able to make that perception real? If you are able to actually come to terms with the idea that you're going to die, you're going to let go, right? When you see suffering, this is suffering, you're going to let go of those things because you don't want to hold on to something which is painful. So the natural consequence of proper contemplation of the Dhamma in the right way is letting go. And letting go means the ending of craving, right? Or at least the diminishment of craving, and the kind of letting the object go its own way, just allowing it to be as it is. And of course, when you let go of the craving, then you become peaceful, right? If there's no craving there, the craving is the thing which moves the mind. Take away the craving, take away the anger or the negativity, the mind becomes peaceful. So developing the mind from the point of view of, you might call that vipassana if you like, but from the point of view of wisdom, that also leads to calm. Developing from the point of calm leads to wisdom. The two always must go together. These are like this, basically, completely and fully interrelated to each other. And it's quite easy to see why that is the case. So this is how meditation works. And meditation, basically, is about overcoming defilements, stage by stage. And both samatha and vipassana are actually involved in that particular process. They must always go together here. So the purpose here, the main purpose, at least initially, is actually to overcome the defilements of the mind, to overcome the hindrances, and then as you do that, gradually samatha and vipassana become more and more powerful, and then eventually, of course, that leads to samadhi, and that leads to yata bhuta nanadasana, seeing knowledge and vision of things as they have become. Is that right, Bhante? Something like that, yeah? Okay. And of course, those, again, are just deeper aspects of samatha and vipassana in turn, right? The whole thing moves in that direction here. Okay, so let's do a little bit of meditation here. Ja. Okay, so just very briefly again, the idea that I'm trying to bring forth here is the idea that samatha and vipassana are essentially, they are two aspects of a similar kind of mind state. There's the aspect of samatha, which is calm, and the aspect of vipassana, which is clarity. And those two things should go together. Calm without clarity is confused, confused kind of calm. Clarity without calm is superficial. Only when the two come together is it actually the right type of state, and they should always come together like that. They are developed, both of these are developed by overcoming defilements and through meditation practice, which is the same kind of path, basically. Okay, so let's move on to the next one here. Satipatthana and Samadhi. It's a very interesting topic. And it took me, I remember when I first started off reading the suttas, it's one of those amazing things. I started reading the suttas, I started to realize that there is a very clear relationship between Satipatthana and Samadhi. It's everywhere found in the suttas. And it's the kind of thing which is an eye-opener, because it's very different from what you are normally used to hearing in from various other people. So it's always very fascinating for me. And one of the first things that you see when you start reading about Satipatthana is that Satipatthana, in other words, often translated as the foundations of mindfulness, right? Which I don't think is a very good translation. I quite like Adan Sudato's idea about just calling it meditation, which I think is quite useful. But one of the first things that you realize about Satipatthana in the suttas is that it actually is used for overcoming the hindrances. This is actually one of the main reasons why we do Satipatthana practice. And you see this again and again in the suttas. Of course, if the defilements are very coarse and very strong, you cannot use meditation to overcome them. A very large part, this is one of the things that Bhante Sujata was talking about this morning, the idea is that sila has to be very firmly established before meditation is possible. Sila has to be there, and when the defilements are very, very, very weakened, both the external defilements of speech and action, but also the internal defilements of the mind, when they are weak, that is when meditation becomes possible. Why? Because mindfulness, being present, is only possible when the defilements are weak. Defilements are strong, it's impossible to stay in the present moment, basically. I'm sure you can have all experienced that from your personal meditation practice. So the purpose of Satipatthana then is to take the mind, that very last little bit, the purpose of meditation, take the mind, that very last bit, from weak defilements to no defilements. Right? From weak defilements to no defilements. That is one of the main purposes of Satipatthana. And you can see there why then it becomes such a powerful technique for taking you to Samadhi. The reason is because Samadhi can only happen. Deep meditation can only happen when there's no defilements in the mind, right? But Satipatthana is this thing which drives you to deep meditation, to Samadhi. So what is it then? If we say that Satipatthana and Samadhi is so closely related to each other, which they are in the suttas, you see that again and again, you see it on the Noble Eightfold Path, you see it in the gradual training, you see it in the five spiritual faculties. All of these cases, always meditation leads to this deep Samadhi state. It's always the same. If that is so, what does that mean for Satipatthana? Is Satipatthana Samatha practice, or is it Vipassana? And the answer, of course, it's neither Samatha nor Vipassana. That distinction doesn't exist in the suttas, right? There is no Samatha meditation. There is no Vipassana meditation. It's just meditation in the suttas. So Satipatthana practice develops both Samatha and Vipassana. Why? Because it decreases the defilements. Like as I said before, when the defilements go down, both Samatha and Vipassana are the result. So you cannot, again, you see here, you cannot actually distinguish these things. And to say that Satipatthana is just Vipassana practice, I think it's a strong misstatement of what you find in the suttas. It includes an aspect of Vipassana, but it also includes just as much the aspect of Samatha, in as much as these things actually are completely inseparable. So Satipatthana is about both Samatha and Vipassana practice. Of course, what we're talking about here is still Samatha and Vipassana at a fairly early stage. I'm not now talking about Vipassana, which is the profound understanding or insights that you have when you reach the awakening stages, when you become an Arya, or you see the truth as it actually is, etc. This is not what this is about. This is about just the gradual clarification of the mind that happens as part of the process of meditation. And this is really what Satipatthana comes down to. A very important part of this, which also was mentioned by Bhante Sujato this morning, is of course the idea that one of the most important expressions of Satipatthana in the suttas is mindfulness of breathing. The Buddha specifically says, and we saw that this morning as well, that Satipatthana fulfills Satipatthana. Mindfulness of breathing fulfills Satipatthana. So you do mindfulness of breathing, that's all you have to do. Isn't that a wonderful thing? I find it such a beautiful thing. All you have to do is watch the breath, and Satipatthana takes care of itself. It's not a very complicated practice. You don't have to do all these various types of exercises. You don't have to try to think out, well, how should I do contemplation of mind? How does actually that's done? Do I just sit there and watch my mind? Of course you can do that. That's one thing to do. But actually, it is also fulfilled simply by mindfulness of breathing. It makes things very simple and straightforward. And so I say, in the suttas, this is the main expression of Satipatthana as we find it in the suttas. That's all you have to do is mindfulness of breathing. And then lastly, we have this idea again that Satipatthana leads to samadhi. It leads to the jhanas. This is the goal, this is the purpose of Satipatthana practice. It takes you to samadhi. Now, why is this important? It is important because it shows you again the very profound, the very important part of the path that samadhi actually is. The whole purpose here is this movement towards samadhi, because only when you have samadhi, only when you have deep meditation, that you actually will be able to get the real vipassana, so to speak, the real deep insight into things. So everything is really about attaining samadhi. The whole path is a reduction in defilements. Defilements going down and down and down. The visuddhi magga, right? The path of purification. And you purify yourself and purify yourself through the satipatthanas until you get to samadhi. When you see the Noble Eightfold Path, you remember the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. They are, the last three factors are samma padana or samma vayama, which is right effort. Then you have sammasati. Sammasati is just the satipatthanas. Then you have sammasamadhi, right? Sammasamadhi is then right samadhi, jhanas, basically. Then you see the satipatthana wedged in between right effort and right samadhi. Remember that these things are always sequential. These are conditioned sequences, right? So you practice right effort, which basically means the overcoming of the defilements of the mind. That leads to meditation practice proper, which then leads to these deep states of stillness, which is samadhi. You see this again and again and again in the suttas. You would never get that. You might never get that. Perhaps you would if you're very sharp. But it's quite difficult to get that from just reading the Satipatthana Sutta. Because Satipatthana Sutta is not about context. It's about the content of one practice. Only when you see the context can you actually understand what Satipatthana is about. And this context is very, very clear when you look at the suttas more broadly. Okay, so that is Satipatthana and Samadhi in brief for you. So we'll move on to the next one. Bliss. Okay. So this is what I had before, this idea that sometimes people say that you hear that bliss is dangerous or happiness or joy is dangerous in meditation. Is this what the Buddha said? And this was again one of the slides you saw before from Ajahn Sujato, is this idea that actually bliss or piti and sukha are part of the process of meditation practice. There is no meditation without happiness. There is no meditation without joy. It is part of the psychology of meditation. Without that, you're not actually getting the real thing, as the Buddha taught meditation practice. So bliss is not only is it good, it is praised by Buddha many places, not only is it pleasurable, it's something that you want to have, it is actually essential. It is a component that if you haven't got it, it is something that you need to work towards in your meditation practice. And isn't that a wonderful thing? That it is essential. Isn't that a great thing that we have bliss as an essential part of meditation practice? To me, it is one of those wonderful things about the Buddha's teachings. And actually, we encourage bliss. It's an important part of the path. And of course, it feels good, right? At the same time, if it feels good, it's an important part of the path. You've got to do it. And what a wonderful thing, and what a powerful thing that actually is, that this is a part of this. So it is part of the psychology of meditation, part of the movement towards profound meditation is the aspect of happiness. Without that, it's never going to happen. There's no such thing as completely dry meditation practice without any sort of happiness whatsoever. So make the meditation nice and wet with lots of bliss and happiness in it. And then, as you get that bliss and happiness, then meditation happens. It's very obvious why this is the case if you think about it. The reason is very simple. When you're happy, whatever object you're watching, whatever you're doing, if that object is beautiful, it's easy to stay there, right? If you're looking at something very powerful, very beautiful, you get transfixed. It's like watching a movie on TV or whatever it is, which draws you in because of the beauty or the storyline or whatever. It's exactly the same thing with meditation practice. You literally can't keep your eyes off an object that is beautiful. That is why it draws the mind in, and that's how meditation becomes possible. Or everything else becomes irrelevant compared to the meditation. Now, lastly, is this idea of attachment to bliss. Is it possible to be attached to the bliss of meditation practice? The answer to that probably is possible. It may not be possible during the meditation itself, but certainly after the meditation, you think back, you think, wow, that was beautiful, that was wonderful. And then you attach to that experience that you had before. That is certainly possible. So does that mean that we should be careful with these attachments? Does it mean that we should avoid the bliss because you might get attached to it? And the answer is, of course, no. Of course you shouldn't avoid it. What you should do instead is deal with the attachment, right? If bliss is part of the path, and you have to have it to achieve meditation, you can't just chuck it out and say, I'm not going to do it because I might get attached to it. That's completely the wrong idea. What you have to do instead is deal with the attachment. And very much of Buddhism is actually precisely to deal with attachments, right? You often hear Buddhists say, oh, I shouldn't be attached because I'm a Buddhist. Now, for starters, that's not a very wise thing to say, I shouldn't be attached, because you're going to be attached, right? If you shouldn't be attached, but you are attached, you're going to get into perhaps a guilt feeling, or feeling, oh, I'm not really, doing things the Buddhist way or whatever. So that is actually the wrong idea, because the point is, of course, that if you have a sense of self, if you are an ordinary human being, you will have attachments. This is the very meaning of a sense of self, is that you have attachments. It's what a sense of self does. You cannot separate the idea of a sense of self from attachments. They always go together. So you have to expect that you're going to have attachments. So the idea in Buddhism is not to say, oh, I shouldn't have attachments. Rather, it is to use your attachments in a wise way. And in the beginning, you will, of course, be attached to some extent to virtue, to kindness, right? You take it up, I'm going to be attached to kindness, I'm going to be attached to virtue. And that's fine. In fact, the suttas say that one of the qualities of an Arya, of a stream enterer, is precisely as only when you become an Arya that you no longer have attachment to virtue. This is called the sila bhatta paramasa, which literally means the holding on to sila and bhatta. Bhatta is a word for bhatta, which means like vows or things that you undertake, particular practices you undertake. So if you attach to these things, it just means that you're not a stream enterer yet. That's all it means. So of course, there should be a level of attachment to virtue. And as you practice the path, you go to higher stages, and there will be an attachment always at each stage as you move on. This is natural. It's nothing to be worried or concerned about. It's just that you have to learn to deal with these things in the right way. So you recognize the danger of attachment. You don't hold on so strongly. You allow things to be, and then you move on. And then you're doing the right thing. So recognize that attachments is necessary, is part and parcel of what it means to be a human being, first of all, and then you deal with it in the right way, so that you recognize also the danger in these things that will cause you suffering in the future. So don't worry about if there is some attachment to the bliss. Rather, move forward and see how you can attain these states, attain the meditation in the right way, without allowing this attachment or holding on to become a hindrance for you. Please, of course, Okay, that was the right way around, actually.
Okay, good. just to interject here and just bring in the historical context again, it is very curious when we think of this thing about bliss and pleasure and how totally pervasive it is through the suttas, and the analysis is very clear. And also, as far as I'm aware, through the Buddhist tradition, and certainly through the commentarial tradition and so on. And yet in the 20th century meditation tradition, we find a very strong aversion to pleasure. Certainly something I encountered on my very first meditation retreat. And I went to my teacher and reported, and I felt this amazing bliss and feeling of light and so on. And I was like, oh, just careful with that, don't get that. Because immediately, the first thing you have to learn if you experience pleasure is be afraid of it. And we don't really find this in the Buddhist tradition at all. Certainly not as far as I've seen. And so we're trying to think where it comes from. It was interesting, this is on a slightly unrelated topic, but it was an interesting remarks that was made about a year ago by the Attorney General of India on the subject of the criminalisation of homosexuality. And I've sort of read this as part of my research into the same-sex marriage proposal, representation which we made to the Senate Select Committee last year. But the Attorney General of India was saying that many modern-day Indians and Hindus believe that the opposition to homosexuality is an Indian ethic, it's an Indian idea, and that they, as part of their own native ethics and ethos, that they should reject this Western attempt to say that homosexuality is, there's nothing wrong with it. And the Attorney General was saying, well, actually, this is a complete misreading of the historical situation, and that in the past that India had very liberal, very open ideas to different kinds of expression of sexuality, and that the law criminalising homosexual behaviour in India was in fact introduced by the English. And that the English, and the reason why they introduced it was because in the colonial days, the Indians were so open to different kinds of things that all the gay English gentlemen would go to India for their holidays, right? And so this became the kind of the thing, that you could go to India and we'll all have a great time. And so this, because of that, then they introduced a law banning homosexuality. And then much later, 100 years later or however long it is, then the Indians think, oh, this is our law, this is our ethic, and we've got to stop these corrupt, decadent Westerners from bringing their values into us. And I bring that example up because that locates it very much in a recognisable historical period, which, of course, is what we recognise as a Victorian kind of values, right? This very kind of puritanical attitudes towards sexuality and so on. And I think that this same Victorian ethos has also been absorbed into Buddhist cultures, which, of course, are also colonised in the same period. And from that Victorian time is where we get these ideas and these kinds of meditations. And I think where it actually comes from is from a Victorian fear of pleasure, right? And a Victorian fear of we can't have anything like happiness, especially when it comes to religion, right? That's like really dangerous, yeah? And so that the Buddhist meditation was phrased in a way that would sort of get kind of messy feminine emotions out of the way and make it all about it's rational and it's straightforward and it's all kind of, yes, very kind of, we can all be very serious about it because this is a kind of manly aesthetic exercise. And I think this is the kind of spirit which informed that formulation of Buddhist meditation in the early part of the 20th century, and which later kind of got adopted within the Western sphere as being the kind of the authentic Asian meditation, whereas in fact it was, I think, largely influenced by Western ideas from its formulation. But anyway, that's just my two cents worth.
Okay. I actually think it goes even deeper than that. I think you may be probably right about the Victorians being puritanical, and they may have had a big influence on India. I'm sure that is right. But what is interesting, you read the suttas, and the Buddha says, you know, before his enlightenment, that I was afraid of bliss, because I thought that bliss is not to be attained through bliss. In other words, you don't use bliss in meditation practice to attain the bliss of awakening. Bliss is to be attained through pain, right? This was also current already at the time of the Buddha, and you can see that in the Jaina practice, in all the ascetic practice, that this was actually a very common belief. And then when you look at the various religious traditions around the world, you look at the Christians certainly have this idea of self-mortification, this kind of thing. Apparently you have it in Islam as well. Almost every major religion, of course you have it in Hinduism, almost every major religion had this idea that if you somehow punish yourself, that is going to give rise to release, going to give rise to happiness, right? So I think it is actually something very deeply ingrained in the human psyche that, you know, we think automatically that unless there is some very, very good evidence to the contrary, and fortunately there is, it's all found in the suttas, but unless there is good evidence to the contrary, actually pain is the way to happiness. And maybe it has some idea with the idea, maybe with the body it being bad or evil or something like that, taking you away from peace or whatever, I don't know. But it seems to be very, very kind of deeply ingrained. And because of that, I think precisely if that is true, then of course that is a very good reason to be careful with this, right? And to actually recognize how important this is in the suttas, and that bliss actually is recommended, something you should develop. It's very much part of part and parcel of the meditation practice. Yes, Eddie. Me, okay. Very good. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's a nice story. Thank you for that. It's a very nice story. That was very, very kind of you to share that one. Okay. Okay, on that nice note, let's do some more meditation. Okay. Okay, let's see what is next. Okay. All right, so next one here, calm and will. And this is about basically, just very briefly, a little bit about the role of will, or maybe the lack of the role of will in meditation practice. And of course, one of the things that I often read about meditation when I was a young monk or starting off on the Buddhist path was this idea of suppression of the hindrances. The idea that the hindrances are supposed to be kind of held down and suppressed. The word suppression, if you look it up, I looked it up before I came here, basically the idea is use of willpower is an important part of this idea of suppression. Not only does it mean willpower, but suppression often has this idea that you put something into the pressure, you kind of, you know, oppress it into the corner in a sense. It's still there, but it's kind of out of sight, right? If you suppress information is still available, but it's just out of sight for the majority of people. The suppression has this idea, not only use willpower, but just, you know, it's still there, you're just kind of moving it out of sight, so to speak. And this, so the idea of suppression is not a very good word for how to abandon the hindrances or to abandon the defilements of the mind. It's much better to just call it elimination or abandoning of these things. And again, this is about the difference here. Using the right terminology gives you a very different idea of what is going on. So the way to abandon the hindrances, get rid of the defilements of the mind, rather than calling it suppression, you should actually use the gradual training throughout the whole Eightfold Path. That is how you eliminate these things. And this was one of those, one of those great things that also arose for me by reading the suttas, understandings that arose for me, is precisely this idea that actually the way to overcome anything negative on the path is through reflection, is through thinking about things in the right way. This was one of the suttas that, Banda Sujata brought up this morning, this idea that there is these two powers, and one is called the power of reflection, one is called the power of development. And the power of development is about attaining deep states of samadhi, about unifying the mind, about attaining, you know, all these things which actually gives rise eventually to awakening even. But the power of reflection is actually how you get rid of defilements in the mind. If you want to practice the three ways of right conduct, it's the power of reflection that gives rise to the three ways of right conduct. It's a very important point. You cannot just sit down and meditate your way out of defilements and problems. You have to reflect wisely. You have to reflect in the right way. How can I not be angry? Well, how can I not be angry? Just by reminding yourself, it doesn't really get you anywhere. It doesn't solve the problem. It usually makes the problem worse. It makes you feel bad on top of that. Then you learn strategies and how to avoid anger by thinking in the right way. How can I avoid getting angry with this person? Okay, focus on another aspect of that person, right? It's all about reflection. How do we think about the object? How do we think about the world around us? That is how, ultimately, you overcome defilements. This is how you eliminate these things. You don't suppress the hindrances. You eliminate them by being wise, by being smart about these things. And this this idea of stillness versus concentration is a very similar kind of thing. This is something that Ajahn Brahm always talks about. The idea that the word concentration in English very often means using willpower, right? And we know what it's like in meditation practice. If you try to force your mind onto the meditation object, after a while the mind gets tired, the mind rebels, the mind doesn't want to do it anymore, and it just doesn't work. It's a bit like going to work, right? You go to work and you have to force yourself to read something or to write a report or whatever. And how do you feel after a full day at work having to force yourself doing something you don't really enjoy? You feel tired, right? You feel exhausted. And that's precisely because that type of concentration involves willpower. So it actually matters quite a lot how you translate words. What do they mean to ordinary people? How do you relate to these words? Concentration, does it mean willpower to you? Or does it just mean that the mind is focused? To many people, it means using willpower, and that's why it is can be a dangerous word. And that's why things like stillness, or perhaps coalescence, or something like that, is probably better, because it doesn't have a sense of forcing things. So both of these words, suppression and concentration, are basically part of the same, can be part of the same problem. So we have to be very careful. And that's, of course, one reason why it's sometimes very useful to go back to the Pali, to see what the Pali has to say about these things, and then take it from there instead. So what is it then? What is this path? And what this path really is like the way of ease, right? The way of, not the way of willpower, but the way of relaxing, the way of easing. And the ease there is a wisdom, is a wise kind of ease. You use the wisdom, you use your understanding, you use your mind in the right way to actually reflect on what you shouldn't be doing and what you should be doing, and then you can actually relax. You don't have to force anything at all. Instead, you can relax in a meditation practice. That, of course, is the kind of meditation which actually works. That is the kind of meditation which gives right to bliss, right? To happiness. When you feel at ease, then happiness becomes possible. If you use force, it's very unlikely you will get much happiness through that kind of practice. Yes, Venerable. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Definitely. That last one there is definitely the same as well. But what it also shows you. I should read the question. Okay. The question is in the Vitakka Santana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 20, the calming of thoughts. It says that you can use the fifth of the five ways of dealing with these thoughts is to use willpower, is suggested here. Or you clench your teeth, or you press the tongue to the roof of the mouth, etc., and you subdue the thoughts that way here. And yes, it certainly sounds like willpower. It's very hard to get away from that one here. But I think that the point there is really that it's the last way, it's the last resort, right? One of the kind of very important ways of interpreting the suttas is to remember that they're always gradual. It always starts, you know, with the most basic thing first. So the most basic thing there is overcoming them by substitution. Is that the first one? You substitute, right? So you just remember this is the wrong way, so you think of something else instead, right? That is the first way. That's basically a wisdom way. Then there is the next one is to overcome them by thinking of the disadvantages of that particular thought, right? Again, it's a wisdom. You have probably built up like a reservoir of wisdom from the past. You have seen the danger of these things in the past. You bring up that past perception in your mind, and you remember the danger. And once you remember the danger, if you see it clearly, it goes like that, right? It's like the idea of a hot coal which burns you. If you have a hot coal in your hand, you don't need to think, should I let go or not? It just goes. And then you have the idea of just allowing it to stop, I think, is the third one. Or just not paying attention, right? Not paying attention to it, right? And then the fourth one is the calming of the sankhara, which is the willpower behind it. This is actually calming of the willpower. It's the exact opposite. So it is the idea there, the simile there is that a person is walking. Why am I walking? Maybe I should stand still. Why am I standing there? I should sit down. I should lie down, right? And it's the calming of the sankhara. Sankhara means will. So calming the sankhara, you're calming the driving force behind that thought. So this is the opposite of using willpower. And then the last one is actually the using of the willpower here. So this is actually very important. It's, you know, this is a gradual. You try, the first one is the most powerful one. That is the one you should really use, ideally. That doesn't work, do the second one. And it's like in absolutely desperate situations when nothing else works, that's when you use the willpower here. So this is very an important part of this.
This is also shown in a study by Johannes Bronckhorst on Indian early Buddhist meditation, comparing Buddhist meditation with Jaina meditation. Is effectively that last one is basically shared in common with Jain meditation, whereas all the rest of the Buddhist meditation has that quite a distinctive flavour of the relaxed, the easeful, the peaceful approach to things. But whereas that one is the last step in the Buddhist meditation, it was the first step in the Jaina meditation. So Jain meditation starts out by forcibly suppressing your mind, and then it gets more severe as you go along. So not only is it the final step, it's also, if you like, the least Buddhist of any of those steps. Yeah. It's just when you really have to panic. Yeah, he's getting out of control.
You're saying that this idea of suppressing the hindrance seems to be very common in Buddhism, like across very many different traditions. But again, remember, this is a matter of terminology here, right? And the idea, I think, that people have is that the hindrances are suppressed because they still have the potential for coming back up again. So they call that suppression. But actually, it's not really suppression. Because the idea of suppression to me is like you push it into the corner, and then it sort of sits there in the corner somewhere, and it comes back, you know, raging back again later on. But that's not really what it's about. What it's about is actually a temporary elimination of the hindrances. They're completely gone. That's really what it is. When they're not there, they're not there. They're completely gone. And it's not eliminated by force. It is eliminated through insight, ideally, with the exception of this this one case in the Vitakka Santana Sutta. I think it's just a matter of how terminology is used. If you understand the word suppression in the right way, and I think many of these terms have many different ways of looking at them, then it's okay. But if you grasp it the wrong way, it can be quite dangerous. This is, pointing out the danger in some of this terminology here. So, yeah. Danya. What is the Pali term for that one? Pahana, I think, which means like abandoning. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I can't remember what the word is in Pali in the Kwel Sutta. But it could be. If it is translated with abandoning, it's quite likely it's the same word. I can't remember the context in the question off the top of my head, so I can't really comment on that. So I'm not really sure. Yes, Annie. I think that's part of it. I think the problem often is that you can see that the unwholesomeness is so strong that you're about to act on it, about to do something with it. And that is when it gets very dangerous, right? It's so strong that now I'm about to say something bad. Okay, let's be careful here. And that's kind of the situation where you might want to do it. But again, I think one of the problems there is very often a psychologist would probably tell you to be very careful with suppressing these things. Because if you suppress them in the wrong way, it might have very, very detrimental psychological consequences. So you've got to be very careful with these things, and you've got to be very skillful with how to use these even such simple tools. Exactly. So you have to be very careful. It's wisdom. It's actually understanding these things, reflecting them in the right way, which is the most powerful tool that really actually works in the long run. I think that's quite right.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that it's the problem, almost regardless of what kind of translation you use, there's always going to be a problem with any translation. So what you do with translation, sometimes you suggest many kind of synonyms, and then you kind of hone in on what basically it means by using synonyms. And this is what we find in the Pali Suttas. Very often the Buddha will use different terminology to point to the same thing. And kind of the cumulative kind of weight of all the different terminology will point you towards what it actually means. It's very common in the suttas. So you're probably right, elimination maybe sounds a bit kind of forceful as well, perhaps, you know. So maybe abandoning is better. Then that might have its own kind of... But then slowly we're getting towards the point here. It's one of the advantages of discussing these things. Alleviation. Okay. Yeah. Okay, maybe, yeah. Eddie, yeah. It's gradual. Everything is gradual. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. Needs to be gradual. Yeah. That is true. Yeah. Okay. Let's just sit another 10 minutes before we end off the last half an hour here. Okay, let us move on now. So far it's been very kind of theoretical, so let's look at a fairly practical example of how this works. This is one of the readings that was part of the coursework. This is a sutta which is usually known as the Meghya Sutta, and it's a very nice sutta, and it shows you how the interlinking of many of these various factors that we have been looking at. In particular, it looks at five kind of supports or kind of foundations, if you like, for meditation practice, and then how meditation then moves on from those five supports and how these things are actually linked together. So let's start off by having a look at the supports, the five supports, first of all. The background of the story. Okay. Yeah, okay. Probably that's a good idea, actually. Okay. So this sutta is a monk called Meghya. He was one of the first attendants of the Buddha, and he was staying with the Buddha in a certain place, and then one morning he went in for alms round, and when he went for alms round, he saw this beautiful grove, beautiful place, and he thought to himself, this is where I want to meditate in the afternoon. So he comes back to the Buddha, and he says to the Buddha, a venerable sir, could I please go off to this grove that I saw and go meditating there? And the Buddha says, no, wait, we are alone, wait till somebody comes along here. And then he asks two more times, and eventually the Buddha sort of, okay, since you're talking about striving, what can I say? So, do as you see fit, so to speak. Yeah. That's what the Buddha says. It's very stubborn, this Meghya fellow. Yeah. And then he goes off to this grove, and when he goes to meditate there, he has all these defilements in his mind. He has these thoughts of ill will and anger and desire, and all these things coming up in his mind. Which, of course, means that he can't meditate. So then he comes back to the Buddha and says, oh, it's amazing, it's astonishing. I've been trying so hard, I've been doing, sitting in the right place in a quiet, nice grove. And still, what I have is all these bad thoughts coming into my mind. And then the Buddha gives him this sutta, this particular sutta here.
Sorry, if I could just interject then.
Yeah.
That introduction gives me great solace as a meditation teacher. Even when people listened to what the Buddha said, they still ignored him and went off and did their own thing. And it also gives me great faith in the Buddha, because then when he came back, if someone did that to me and they came back, I said, well, I told you so. But the Buddha doesn't say anything like that. He's very kind of calm and helpful and so on. But these things, are very interesting, because they really did happen. People would listen to something, even a great teacher like the Buddha, and then you think, no, I know better. I'm going to go off and do my own thing. And I think one of the messages of this sutta is that often we have this ideal that somehow by just going away and meditating in seclusion that we'll be able to solve all our problems. I mentioned this a little bit earlier. Somehow if our meditation's not working, we've got to meditate harder, we've got to meditate more, we've got to find a nicer place, it's got to be quieter. But often that's not the thing that really matters. And I think what the five supports is pointing to, I think, what for many people actually is much more significant in really supporting meditation.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Okay, the idea is that because the Buddha is a teacher, he's supposed to have an attendant at all times. So because there's nobody else around and the attendant wants to leave, he loses the attendant, so to speak. Yeah. Right, basically, essentially. Because that was his job, was to be around the Buddha at the time. Yeah, he was the main attendant, essentially. Yeah, yeah. So what the Buddha then says is that based on that, he says to Meghya, well, the reason your meditation doesn't work is basically because you're lacking these five supports, right? These are the five supports that make meditation work. Yeah. And these are, of course, then very much related to what we talked about before, the idea that you have to have sila, or virtue, before meditation actually starts. So let's see what these five supports are. Okay, so the first one is the good friendship, the Kalyanamitta, right? So this is like the Kalyanamitta group we have here at the Buddhist Society. Yeah, that's the idea.
Which is meeting after this, is that right?
Meeting after this, okay.
Yeah, okay, so Kalyanamitta ad. Anyone wants to fulfill this first one, then go along to Kalyanamitta.
Yeah, that's all, exactly. But of course, it's not quite as simple as that, according to the Buddhist teachings, because the idea in the Buddha's teachings about Kalyanamitta is not just good friendship in the sense of hanging out together, right? It's about friendship that actually gives rise to the good qualities in you. So the ideal good friend is actually the Buddha himself, right? He is actually the true Kalyanamitta in the suttas. The reason why this is the very first factor on the path, is because this here is kind of mirrored in the Noble Eightfold Path itself. The Noble Eightfold Path begins with right view. A good friendship, having a good spiritual friend, is precisely the type of person that gives rise to right view in you. And that is why the Buddha is so important. That's why the Buddha is so essential. So you can actually see here that it's like this is almost mirroring how the Noble Eightfold Path works, how the gradual training works. Right view comes first. That's what good friendship basically is all about. And this is also why, the Buddha said elsewhere that good friendship is 100% of living the spiritual life. Why? Because it is the first factor. If you haven't got the first factor, nothing takes off, right? So you have to have that one. Then the rest of this path actually comes into being. So good friendship here really means like the right view of the Noble Eightfold Path. Then when you have a right view, what happens next? You become virtuous, right? You do all the things. And these are the virtues, in particular the virtues we talked about before. It was about right conduct and right speech and all these kind of things. And then, of course, that is the beginning of abandoning the defilements, abandoning the negative aspects of the mind. And then you have the next one here is quite an interesting one. I just abbreviated to teachings. It's actually quite expanded in the sutta itself. And what the sutta says is that once you have virtue, what you have to do is you have to get access to those teachings that are inspiring. And in particular, it mentions teachings like talk on contentment, talk on desiring little, talk on arousing energy, talk on seclusion, talk on not being a kind of socializing, talk on virtue, talk on meditation, and talk on wisdom, and talk on liberation. And there's one more, which is even... So those are basically the kind of topics here. And very fascinating topics. There's nothing there. If you think about it, there's nothing there about the Four Noble Truths, nothing there about ordinary Dhamma talks, about dependent origination, nothing about all these technical issues, right? All of this talk we're talking about here is like inspiring talk about how to be contented, how to do all the right things on the path, how to enjoy seclusion, how not to hang out with your mates too much, you know, socializing. And then, of course, Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. So it's inspiring talk. And this is very fascinating. This comes after virtue. And it's only when you have that inspiration, in a sense, that you start practicing the teachings properly. You find this in another place in the suttas. You find this in the Mahasunyata Sutta, which is the Majjhima Nikaya 122. You find exactly the same kind of distinction. And the Buddha says to Ananda, you have heard enough teachings. You have heard enough there in use of the teachings. Sutta, Vyakarana, and Gaya. These are the suttas are like the Buddha's straightforward teachings. Vyakarana, explanations, if you like. Gaya are suttas with verse. You've heard so many of these teachings. This isn't what you need. Forget about that. You've heard enough of those things. What you need is talk that inspires you. Talk exactly this kind of talk that you find here. And I think this is one of the most important things in Buddhism, and one of the important things that we always need is this nourishment that keeps us going on the path. There comes a point when you have understood the teachings well enough, and all you really need from a Dhamma talk is something to inspire you, to remind you this is important, so that you desire to meditate, you desire to do what is right. And that inspiration is actually so powerful and so effective on this path. And this is one of the wonderful things with my own teacher, Ajahn Brahm, and many others here, is precisely he has that ability to inspire you, right? He can sort of lift your mood up and make you feel good and make you want to practice. He certainly does that in the monastery, and I'm sure he does that here in Dolamara as well. And that is enough. You don't need to learn anything new. You don't need to talk about the five hindrances or the seven factors of enlightenment or dependent origination, as long as you feel inspired. This is one of those fundamental things that drives you forward on the path. You want to do what is right. So this is very fascinating. This actually comes here as an intermediate step after virtue. Very powerful, I think, and very, very interesting. You don't see this all that many places in the suttas, but that list of 10 topics you certainly do see. And then, based on that inspiration, comes the effort, right? You are inspired. You want to purify yourself. And the effort here is specifically the effort to purify your mind, to abandon unwholesome states, whatever that is, whatever that effort is. And a lot of that effort is just to remind yourself of what is dangerous, what you shouldn't be doing, how you should practice, tweaking your mind, so you're learning to look at the world in a new way. A lot of the Buddhist path is actually changing perceptions. One of the interesting things when you start reading a text like the Anguttara Nikaya, there's a whole set of suttas there that talk about perception, how to develop perception. It's something you don't actually hear about very often, but there must be at least 10 or 20 suttas that talk about different perceptions and how to develop them. And a very important part of that is to learn to perceive the world in such a way that you don't have defilements in the mind, right? And this is such an important part of the Dhamma. This is like the wisdom aspect of the Dhamma. And this is very much what right effort is about. Understanding this. You can see here again how Satipatthana and Sammatthana and Vipassana come together, so to speak. This is learning to perceive things. And then, of course, come the benefits from that. And then, once that right effort starts to ripen in calm, starts to ripen in clarity, then, of course, the wisdom starts to arise. The wisdom here is a bit different from the other factor, because the wisdom here actually refers to, it is called the wisdom of arising and passing away. So this is basically a wisdom that sees the truth of things, sees reality. So it's actually a very deep kind of wisdom. It's said to be noble and penetrative. It penetrates to the truth. And because of that, it's actually a fairly profound thing here. So these five supports, because the wisdom is so profound and deep, it is not necessary to have these in full necessarily, but it's, of course, the more you have of them, the more supportive they are for your meditation practice. This is how they work together. Yes. These things are what concerns the abandoning of the hindrances, right? This is what you do to abandon the hindrances. Upadi. That is towards the very end of the sutta, right? Usually it would. It would normally refer to the spiritual faculties. Yes. Yeah. 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 The idea here is basically, this is the initial part of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? The initial part of the Noble Eightfold Path is by purifying yourself. And when you reach enough purity, then meditation starts to work. This is what it's all about. So this is how you purify yourself to the point where meditation actually can work. This is what it's all about. So, and that is actually a very important point, because one of the things I think that people, one of the mistakes that people often do in meditation, and here you see these things, they're actually said to be supports for meditation. One of the mistakes that is often done is that you start to do meditation too early. You're not ready for meditation practice yet. The mind isn't peaceful enough. You haven't got enough clarity. Mindfulness isn't strong enough, right? Why isn't it strong enough? Well, precisely because you haven't done enough of these supports. You can have a different list of supports if you like, but this is roughly what is required. And one of the things that you see in the Satipatthana Sutta, you see it also in the Anapanasati Sutta, it starts off with saying that you have to be mindful to do that. Satipatthana Sutta specifically says Satima. Satima means having mindfulness. So without that mindfulness, you cannot really do Satipatthana. So mindfulness is a prerequisite to be able to do this. Anapanasati is exactly the same thing. You have to be mindful before you can even do these things. And this is why this is so this is so significant and so important. That mindfulness arises because of these supports. That's where it comes from. Okay. So these are the supports, and when you have these supports, then you have these four types of meditation practice. These are called bhavana. So this is one of those words that we talked about before, which actually means development or cultivation. Citta bhavana, quite literally cultivation of the mind. And you can see here you have a sequence of different types of meditation. And of course, as always in Buddhism, the actual sequence itself is important. Actually, I should mention that in the previous one as well. You see, the sequence here is important, right? Good friendship is right view. Then you have the sila or virtue. You have the teachings to inspire you. Then you have the effort to abandon even more defilements. And that then results in wisdom. So these things have a very clear sequence here. And in the sutta, they're actually specifically said to be a sequence as well, the condition sequence. So then, having that basis, then you can do meditation practice precisely because your mindfulness is powerful enough. And the first part here, unattractiveness, this is usually considered to be, this is called asubha in Pali, and this is just a reminder of what the body is like. And you find this as the very first part of the Satipatthana Sutta. This is usually one of the most important exercises, one of the most important meditations, if you like, of the Satipatthana Sutta. And you can see why this is important. What is the point of this? What is the point of remembering the unattractiveness of the body? What are we actually doing here? And what you're doing is just basically reminding yourself of the nature of the body, right? And usually the best body to do it on is your own body. That's the one that really matters. So the idea here is not to kind of get kind of revulsion or with the body. It's just to neutralize some of the attachments, to neutralize the desires. And it's very obvious how that happens. You know, there's that old saying, beauty is only skin deep. And if you peel the skin off a human body, it's not going to be the same as when it has skin on it. There is a big difference there. And this is just remembering the nature of this body, what it really is like. And that is enough to take away some of the desires and the attachments. So the point again is to abandon defilements, abandon the problems that actually stop you from attaining samadhi, right? This is what it's about all the way through, abandoning defilements, abandoning hindrances, abandoning the problems in the mind. And the reason why this one is the first is because this is one of the most serious, one of the most difficult of the hindrances to abandon, the attachment to sensuality, including to the body itself. And then the next one is loving kindness. It's great to balance this idea of unattractiveness with loving kindness. I should perhaps say that the idea of unattractiveness of the body is normally considered a monastic practice. It's certainly important for monasticism, but it can also be employed by lay people to some extent. Certainly when one goes on retreat, it can be useful there. But then you have the nice counterweight, right? The counterweight is the loving kindness. And that is where you see the beauty in things. You see the beauty in other people, but you're focusing on the spiritual aspects instead. And of course, this then is the counterweight to anger, right? To the other of the two main defilements. So you're countering the sensuality, which is the worst one, and then you counter any kind of anger or irritation or ill will in the mind is the second one. And you can see again, this then forms the foundation. This is when mindfulness becomes possible, when you develop these things. And that is why mindfulness of breathing comes next. And this is where Satipatthana really starts to take off. So the fourth meditation here is then the mindfulness of breathing. You can see the gradual approach here, how things actually work all the way down. Five supports, and then the gradual types of meditation you can employ. And this is important, right? That mindfulness of breathing comes at this particular stage. It doesn't come earlier. This is where it starts. And this is, I think, again, one of those things that people often forget. When you read the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta, the very first part of that sutta, at the very beginning, it starts off by saying that you, at the beginning, you go to a secluded place, right? And then you sit down, you fold your legs, you straighten your back, having established mindfulness. That's what it says. And that very first part of the sutta is the one that you maybe don't hear so often. I noticed that when Bandhasiddhartha was showing it before, that was actually left out. And yet, that is very important, because that shows you the requirement, the basis on which mindfulness of breathing is possible. If anything is important at sutta, that might perhaps be the most important part. Because once that is established, the meditation happens pretty much by itself, because mindfulness is there. Not much more you have to do. And that's when willpower becomes really redundant and not necessary. Yeah. So then, mindfulness of breathing happens by itself. And then the last part here is then called the perception of impermanence. And this is really where we are kind of moving into the territory for next month, which is the wisdom territory. Once you establish the mindfulness of breathing properly, you get to the stage of samadhi, that is when the perception of impermanence becomes really powerful. And this, of course, is the point where you can start moving towards the enlightenment experiences and that sort of thing. Yeah. But that is really for next month, when we start talking about that. The idea here, when you look at the sutta for mindfulness of breathing, is that the perception of impermanence is actually included in that particular sutta. And so a lot of this impermanence here relates back to the process that happens in the sutta, and then you take it further to include all the five khandhas. And this is how, according to this, you abandon the conceit, I am, which is often translated as. So those then are the four meditations that are based on the five supports. Everybody happy with that? That makes sense. Yeah. So, yes, Ananda. I think it is a bit of both. It is, yeah. I think that if you are, you know, you've been on the Buddhist path for a long time and you attain a deep stage of samadhi, it is probably quite natural that you will actually, the mind will move towards the perception of impermanence, because you are kind of, that's what you have been told, right? So there may be a slight intention there as well, but you don't need very much intention at that particular point, because the mind is already so peaceful. The mind is very willing to obey whatever orders you have because of the power of the mind at that particular point. So it's kind of a bit of both, I think, yeah. 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 Which ones, sir? These four. Yeah. They can be. They can be done independently of each other. You know, the perception of impermanence can be very useful just to overcome defilements in its own right. So you can remind yourself, as you know, as I said before, death contemplation is really a perception of impermanence to a large extent. Mindfulness of breathing. But I think the point is here that you have to, one of the most important things on the Buddhist path is to know where you're at. What are your problems on the path? What is that you have to deal with? And once you understand what your problem is, where on the path you are, then you can apply yourself in the right way, right? And the vast majority of people will have defilements that need to be overcome. So you need to kind of try to deal with those defilements. So loving kindness is always, I think, a very powerful meditation that everybody probably could do more of, not just formally, but also in daily life. A large part of it is how you act, how you interact with other people, how you think about other people. These are things you can work on all the time, basically. And loving kindness, not only does it have the benefit of overcoming anger, but it also has a tendency to overcome desire as well, because you're just more content. If you have a sense of metta, you're more content in life, right? And that will then support you. So when you then eventually go on retreat, you can actually watch the breath. A lot of the time, it is very hard. Many people find it very, very hard to watch the breath. And the reason is because in ordinary life, there's just too many things going on. Too many defilements, too many distractions, too many things happening. So for that reason, do those things that actually prepare you. Do the supports, and then you're kind of moving in the right direction. Yeah, Eddie. Good, yeah. That is one way of doing it. Of course, this perception can be expanded, can be used in many different ways. That is certainly one good way. Yeah. So, okay, let me just summarize just very briefly the idea behind what I've been saying just now. And the idea here is basically to point out that samatha and vipassana, calm and clarity, are not two separate things. They are one intertwined thing. When you have calm, you're also supposed to have clarity. When you have clarity, you're also supposed to have calm. They must go together. And only when they go together, when they're one thing, are they really useful on the Buddhist path. And they go together and they arise from the same cause. And that cause is an abandoning of the defilements. As the defilements go down, both of these two become stronger. And the way to do that, the main way that the suttas show you, is satipatthana. Satipatthana is the way both to samatha and vipassana. It leads to both of these qualities because it abandons the defilements. And for that reason, it actually takes you to samadhi itself. It takes you to the jhanas. So satipatthana is basically the cause for samadhi, for jhana. So that is just a very brief summary of what I've been saying so far. And that is also 2:30, that's also the timer. So probably good to end there. Bhante, you want to take over here?